This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, a suicide bomber assassinated the governor of an Afghan province. Today, another attacked his funeral, killing six. Suicide bombs used to be rare in Afghanistan. Now, almost 50 this year. The Taliban that fled in disarray 5 years ago has returned with new weapons and fresh recruits to challenge what's now a NATO-led force in the east and southeastern parts of the country. Last week, NATO Commander General James Jones appealed to member countries to send reinforcements. Reconstruction proceeds fitfully in some places, not at all in others. Corruption continues to be a problem. It's believed that there was a record crop of opium poppies this year. The central government in Kabul has little control over some parts of the country, and many await the progress they were promised. There's more fighting in Afghanistan now than there has been since the fall of the Taliban, and no one knows how much longer it will continue. Later on in the program, we'll take a look at the new Al-Qaeda video and the story of the summer intern who took stories from the U.S. military and planted them in Iraqi newspapers. But first, Afghanistan, 5 years after 9/11. In just a moment, General Jones joins us, so if you have a question about the military situation or the transfer to NATO command, give us a call now. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And our first guest is General James Jones, commander of the U.S. European Command and Supreme Allied Commander of NATO's military forces. He's with us from the headquarters of Allied Powers Europe in Mons, Belgium. General, nice to have you on the program.
Neil, thanks very much. It's good to be with you.
Last week, you called for NATO members to commit more troops to southern Afghanistan. How many more do you need? Why has this been so difficult?
Well, it's really a question of rounding out the plan and the troops that were scheduled for that plan a little bit earlier than we had anticipated. We are basically asking that the remaining 15% of the troop list that has been approved by nations be filled, particularly the emphasis on a maneuver battalion that we feel the commander of the NATO mission in Afghanistan needs to have the flexibility, not just in the south, but throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. And this additional 15%, that doesn't sound like a lot.
It isn't. It's really perhaps... not even quite 2,000 troops, but it's the enablers that come with it. Some attack helicopters, some C-130s for inter-theater airlift, but most of all, it's a maneuver battalion that can be put at his disposal to swing the force anywhere he wants to, anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm. In recent days, I think in the past 10 days, NATO forces in Afghanistan have reported killing 400 insurgents?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but there's no question that in the southern part of the country where we have just expanded, we've expanded into an area where there have not been many permanent forces, if any, over the past several years. And in the south central region, the traditional home of the Taliban, it's the home of Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. It's the home of the opium producing narcotics cartels. It's been rampant with crime and corruption. And there has been very little reconstruction in that part of the country. So I've likened it to poking at a beehive, and now the bees are swarming, but I have no doubt that we're going to be successful. And I think it's very important that the people of that region also see that reconstruction and a better way of life can come their way. But right now it's not an easy time.
As you know far better than I, getting troops into the field is far more than a matter of sticking an AK-47 in a teenager's hand. These troops have to be trained, they have to be fed, they have to be equipped with food, water, ammunition, all the things that anybody's soldiers need.
Right.
Where are all those things coming from?
Well, there's enormous capacity in the alliance. We have 26 nations that are members. This is an alliance that has...
I apologize, General. I was actually talking about the other side. Where do you think...
Oh, the other side.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years after the camps have been driven out of Afghanistan.
Right. Well, I think it's clear that we have an access problem from Pakistan that we're working on with the Pakistani authorities to try to curtail. But I also think that this region, this particular region in the South, has been, in fact, a safe haven. We just haven't, not having had any permanent presence there, we've never really run up against them. And I think that, this is a test right now. It's a test to see if, in fact, the alliance is going to stand and assert itself, and I think it will. It's a test to see if the Karzai government can bring some development and reconstruction to the area once the fighting is over, and I think it will. And I think I think this is a predictable, although the intensity, I have to admit, was a little surprising, but it's a everyone predicted some resistance in the South because we just simply haven't had the presence there that we've had in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, when the transfer to NATO was first brought about, I mean, there was at least an impression that many of the countries involved did not think this was going to be a heavy combat assignment, that this was going to be reconstruction and protection, that sort of thing.
That's a fair statement concerning the how NATO approaches its traditional mission. But in Afghanistan, the alliance approved a very robust set of rules of engagement for its forces, and has shown that it does have, when challenged, it does have the capacity to do what needs to be done. Our first order of business is, in fact, to help the people of Afghanistan move towards a freer democracy and a better way of life with better hope for the kids and their children. We have over 6 million Afghan students going to school, 2 million of which are women, young girls. 80% of the people in Afghanistan have access to health care. Roads are being built. Electricity is being brought to regions that have never had any. Wells are being dug. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's clear to me, at least after working on this problem for almost 4 years, that the people themselves in Afghanistan want a better life, and they don't want to return to the Taliban. And I think that's what we're about to give them.
We're talking with General James Jones, NATO commander, who's just back after an assessment visit to Afghanistan. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Mike is on the line. Mike's calling from Long Island in New York.
Good afternoon. I have a huge amount of questions, but the first might be, what's the strategic significance at this point of anybody being in Afghanistan? It seems like we just blow up countries and then go back and rebuild them, and there's plenty of people in America that have the same needs as they do overseas. We're not after Osama, so...
All right. I think General Jones might dispute you on that point, but let him speak for himself.
Okay.
Well, I think, absolutely, Afghanistan is an important country from a strategic standpoint, from as the traditional home of terrorism that was absolutely proven a few years ago. I also believe that that it's the it's also a cradle of narcotic producing problems that infect the West, particularly Europe, as a matter of fact. And I think that the people of Afghanistan have shown a tremendous amount of courage in raising their hands for democracy and freedom.
Okay.
And so we have the choice of, it seems to me, of helping them along that road, and it certainly is encouraging that the people want this, and also making sure that this country doesn't revert back to being a haven for a terrorist that will export their methods throughout the world. It is a fact of life that terrorism is a global problem. We need to confront it where it is, and it is still there in Afghanistan. And I'd rather fight it there than I would, on the shores of the European countries or in the United States.
Okay. Well, some 30 years ago, I was in the Middle East in Israel working on a kibbutz, and at the time, young children in day schools were given comic books saying that Israel and the United States were Satan, and they should be killed.
Right.
And it's two generations later, and this has come to fruition. Hmm. It seems to me that big business in America and abroad have basically taken advantage of other nations and set up social classes or a caste system where people are disenfranchised. And in that respect, are easily turned to terrorists. And rather than killing these people with guns, it seems like propaganda, which is something that we do a lot of, might be a better way to bring people into the fold and let them realize that, you know, there is help out there. But on the other hand, we've gone after Iraq and we've gone into Afghanistan, and the problem is really Saudi Arabia and Iran,
Mike,
and even Pakistan.
Mike, we're going to be talking about propaganda a little bit later in the show, but I wanted to thank you very much for the call.
I'll drop this, but I hope you guys continue. And
all right.
I think the greatest issue facing this country now is the rigged voting machines from Diebold. So I hope you guys go on that.
A little off the topic, Mike, but we'll bear in mind as we get closer to Election Day. Thanks very much for the call. I wanted to see if we could get Rodell. Rodell's calling us from South Bend in Indiana.
Yes, my question for the general, I was in the National Guard, and I've just returned home. I've only been home for a year now. For the general, how much help have we been able to give them? We've tried to give them so much help when I was stationed over there, and we tried to make improvements. I was stationed right outside of Kabul, and just how much help in this past year have we been able to give the Afghan people?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that on that score we've done pretty well. Let me tell you that since you were there, the Afghan army is probably the single biggest success that we've had in rebuilding it and getting it out in the field. It's an army that, as you know, the Afghans are pretty good fighters, so our challenge has been to make good soldiers out of them. They are contributing.
Yes, sir.
They are contributing in the field. It's an army that's supported by its people, and they're going to They're going to continue to grow. They're at about 35,000 right now, going close to 40. We have a lot of work to do. I won't tell you something that isn't true. That we have a lot of work to do, in my opinion, in rebuilding the police force. And by we, I mean the international.
General, I'm afraid it's also true that we're running out of time.
Okay.
Rodell, thanks very much for the call. And General, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
General James Jones, NATO commander. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After almost 5 years of battling the Taliban in Afghanistan, violence there continues. In some areas, it's intensifying. In just a moment, we're going to talk with a reporter in Kabul about the situation there and what's happening around the country. Of course, you're invited to join us if you have questions about what's happening in Afghanistan, what life is like there today, about the military and political situation. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Jonathan Lande has been reporting from Afghanistan for years. He's senior national security correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and he joins us now on the line from Kabul in Afghanistan. Good to talk with you, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
Before this trip to Afghanistan, you were there, I guess, August of last year. How have things changed?
Things are markedly worse here in Afghanistan than they were last August when I was here. The insurgency by the Taliban last year was somewhat restricted to areas immediately adjacent to the Pakistani border in the south and the east. This year now, the insurgency infects the entire southern half of this country, and where there is no face-to-face fighting, as there is going on in the Taliban's southern strongholds of Helmand province and Kandahar province, they have insinuated themselves in villages and towns within about a three-hour drive of Kabul. There are, as you pointed out at the beginning of the program, more than double the number of suicide bombings this year as there were last. And the unpopularity of the Karzai government and the American government is palpably stronger than it was last year.
Is there a sense that foreign troops, Americans among them, have worn out their welcome?
Not exactly. What there is a great deal of disenchantment with the failure of both the Karzai government and the American government to deliver on the promises that were made 4 years ago, 5 years ago, after the Taliban was driven from power. and a great deal of disenchantment over what Afghans see as the inability of the world's mightiest military to have prevented the resurgence of the Taliban. The other interesting aspect is that international aid, among the international aid programs here, has been aid to free media. And over this free media, both the internet and radio and television, Afghans have been seeing what has been developing in both Lebanon and Palestine and Iraq. And that has also compounded their anger at the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Ed. Ed's with us from Sarasota in Florida.
Thank you, Neil. I'd just like to know if your guest has an opinion on the following. If I followed the news properly, about 2 weeks ago, the government of Pakistan came to a so-called truce agreement with all these tribal regions in their country that borders Pakistan.
Borders Afghanistan as well, yes.
An area which I understand is where all these bad guys are pretty much hiding out and forming up to go in and do their deeds in Afghanistan. Given that if you look back over the last few hundred years, the only governments, if you want to use that term, whether it was the British or anyone else, that controlled this area of Afghanistan, controlled little bits of territory around capital areas. Are we realistic in trying to do anything out in these frontier areas?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we going to be any different than any other power? Any other power that was always the great power of that time.
Well, Jonathan Landay, U.S. forces are not allowed into those tribal areas in Pakistan, but General Musharraf's agreement, is it being seen in Kabul as something that's going to ease the problem or add to the problem?
Absolutely not. In fact, I wrote a story last week or the week before about how Western diplomats believe that this agreement, these peace agreements that General Musharraf's regime has made with the insurgents, Islamic insurgents aligned with the Taliban in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and we're talking about North and South Waziristan. In fact, there's an unwritten or unspoken aspect of these agreements, they believe, and that is that the Pakistani authorities are basically saying to the extremists in the tribal areas, don't mess with us anymore. We're taking our troops back into their compounds and their garrisons, and you can go over to the other side of the border and join the Taliban jihad against the Americans, NATO, and the Afghan government. And in fact, the UN, the United Nations, has a very highly respected tracking program, monitoring program, that monitors violent crime and insurgent activity along the border. And they have noted a major increase in both violent crime and insurgent activity since General Musharraf's regime has been negotiating these peace agreements with their own insurgents in the tribal areas.
And just a few minutes before, we were speaking with General Jones, who said clearly the equipment, the training ground, all the logistical support for the Taliban forces in Afghanistan is clearly coming from Pakistan.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, what's different now as opposed to the past is this, that previously most of these insurgents and the Taliban, and then I say both Pakistani extremists, Arab fighters, and the Taliban themselves had been coming through the mountain passes along the eastern, southeastern border of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and that in the wintertime those passes were blocked by snow. The development this time, however, is that the insurgents are coming around from the south, not from the tribal areas of Pakistan, but from Pakistan's province of Balochistan. And though that is desert, that is flat desert, and that doesn't get blocked by snow. And there's a great deal of concern that this year will not see the traditional decrease in violence that takes place during the winter time, but that indeed this conflict will go on all winter.
Ed, thanks very much for the call.
Hey, thank you.
Sarah Chase is a former reporter for NPR News who now runs a nonprofit organization in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She's the author of The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, and she's with us today from a studio in Needham, Massachusetts. And Sarah, nice to have you on the program.
Great to be here. Thanks, Neil.
You've been in Afghanistan, I guess, more or less continually since the fall of the Taliban. I wonder, in what respects has that event changed life in Afghanistan for the better?
Which event? The fall of the Taliban.
Fall of the Taliban, yeah.
It has, particularly in terms of personal liberties. Men can now wear shorter beards or none at all. Women are not by law obliged not to go into the market or not to send their children to school. However, I would say that what's been going on, what you know, your two other guests have been describing up till now, has had a real impact, so that even within my cooperative, for example, when we drove up to Kabul a month ago when I was leaving the country for this little trip, my guys who wear sparkly caps, you know, normally, tied on a big whopping black turban each, and I tied on a big whopping white turban to make that drive up to Kabul, because we didn't want to be too visible. We wanted to blend in. And I'm seeing that more and more, people growing beards, people changing their dress because of the increasing tension.
Well, your organization is based out of Kandahar, a city that, that was the home of the Taliban, the home of Mullah Omar, and a place which is said to be, a lot of people say, is a pretty strong Taliban right now.
Yeah, I mean, here's where I actually disagree with General Jones. He said that basically NATO troops are going to where the Taliban have always been and are stirring it up. That is not the case. Let me tell you that I have been watching an encroachment on the city of Kandahar. It is true that up in the mountains, you know, way north of town, there have been some villages that remain pretty sympathetic and were the initial, starting late 2002, place that the Taliban coming across the border were trying to establish as a safe haven. But we did not have pitch battles at the doors of Kandahar, which is what we have every single day. And we did not have people, you know, even in Kandahar, which was their stronghold, people were really thrilled. Not maybe in as demonstrative a way as people were thrilled in Kabul when the Taliban fell, but they were really looking forward to this, to the Karzai government, backed with a really wide, it wasn't just the United States, but led by the United States International Coalition. They felt like, my God, the nightmare's going to end. And it hasn't, partly because of Pakistan's meddling and partly because of a decision to re-empower warlords and corrupt people in the new Afghan government, which was partly a U.S. decision, which was then basically confirmed by the Karzai government, who at various stages could have removed these people and didn't. And now, you know, this is what John Landay was talking about. The disenchantment with this government is such that people are starting to make room for these re-entering Taliban, not for ideological reasons, not for anything to do with, culture or religion or anything like that, but because this government is preying upon them, is beating them up and brutalizing them and extracting money from them, and because the Taliban, for example, were not corrupt when they were in government. They did not extract bribes at every transaction with an Afghan citizen, and because they performed a lot of the functions that a government ought to perform in a timely fashion, like, you know, administrative stuff. You get a driver's license or, you know, and you could do that in a timely fashion, which you no longer can.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Terry. Terry's with us from Fort Wayne in Indiana.
Yes. It's refreshing to have people that are actually on the ground seeing the situation. I was there a year ago returning students who had been in the United States for a year of study and saw that the infrastructure was just not being built. The schools were still UNICEF tents, 10,000 students in a school built for 2,000, going to school three shifts a day. And in the summer months in Kabul, kids were getting sick from cholera. What's going on? I agree with the prior comments too about the warlords and the everywhere the airport, every service that I saw was controlled by Pashtun ethnic people in Kabul, which ordinarily would not have been the case 30 years ago when I was a Peace Corps volunteer.
Let's get to that question on education. Sarah Chase, you first, then Jonathan Landay.
I actually think that infrastructure has been one of the success stories, so it's pretty depressing to hear that pointed out as what isn't working so well. Of everything that we were trying to do, we, the international community, were trying to do in Afghanistan, you know, the one thing that did happen is some buildings got built and some roads eventually got paved and stuff like that, and it certainly took too long. But I found that what's even worse is when you go inside a school and don't see any books, and when you find out that the teachers are being paid $30 a month, and so they're not going to class, and classes are being taught by class monitors instead of teachers. So unfortunately, the metaphor I like to use is, you know, how does the body deliver oxygen to the muscles? It's not enough for the heart to beat. So we've had, on the very high level, money being appropriated, but you have to get that money out into the blood vessels and all the way to the capillaries where, you know, blood cell lines up behind another and drops off its load of oxygen, and that has not been happening.
Jonathan Landay, what's your impression?
I would agree with that. Definitely there has been progress made in rebuilding schools and having kids go back to school. There is something like 2 million young girls going to school now, where during the Taliban that they were banned from going back to school. But at the same time, there is a school being burnt on average by the Taliban every other day. I met with teachers in a very rural part of Afghanistan last week, where I spent about 10 days halfway between Kabul and Kandahar. And they haven't been paid in 6 months, and yet their salary does go to the provincial administration. And when they go to get their salary, they complain that either they're not paid or the person who's supposed to give them their money demands part of their money in return for giving them the rest.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few books. The facilities are overcrowded. I agree also that infrastructure is sort of one of the areas where there has been some progress in terms of rebuilding, say, the main ring road that circles the country and some ancillary roads. But certainly, once you get beyond them, you're back onto the dirt tracks and rutted goat trails that most of the people in this country have to use to get anywhere in terms of being able to buy supplies, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Terry, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about Afghanistan 5 years after 9/11. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Sarah Chase, your organization is a nonprofit that produces soap. How come soap?
Well, my notion is that the best way to make it easier for people not to grow opium is to make it profitable for them to grow other things. And it turns out that Kandahar, before it was famous for the Taliban, was famous for, you know, pomegranates, which are also hitting the news these days, and almonds and apricots and all that stuff, which is actually very valuable. The problem is that fresh fruit does need infrastructure to get out of where it's being grown, mm-hmm. and that's not so great. You know, fresh fruit is heavy and perishable. So I thought if we transform it into something else and add value in the transformation process, you know. And so we make this absolutely gorgeous hand-molded soap, which is now sold out in 7 shops in the United States and Canada. And, you know, I'm not saying that we in and of ourselves can beat opium, but I do think that a varied economy that includes a lot of processing of some of these really valuable agricultural products is the way to beat opium. And there's unfortunately very little money and attention really being put to things like this, although a lot of lip service is.
We kept hearing, I'm afraid we just have a few seconds left, mm-hmm. but we kept hearing about, you know, agricultural advisors going to, you know, provide advice on what else you could grow profitably.
You don't need to grow anything else. We need the market for what's already being grown. Rosa Damascena makes rose oil, which is the base of all fine perfumes, and it's worth about $10 a milliliter. And it's indigenous, it turns out, to southern Afghanistan. But no one, you know, now there are a couple of rose oil projects, including ours, but you know, it took a number of years to get this going.
Sarah Chase, good luck. Keep clean.
Thank you.
Sarah Chase is a former NPR reporter, the author of The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. She joins us today from Needham, Massachusetts. Jonathan Landay, thanks for staying up to speak with us. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Landay, senior national security correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, with us from Kabul in Afghanistan. When we get back from the break, Al-Qaeda's number two appears in a new videotape. We'll talk about the string of recent videos and what they might mean, plus the self-proclaimed military propagandist and his internship in Baghdad. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.